This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. Today we have with us a very special and extraordinary guest. He published Solving the Communion Enigma, The Key, and Supernatural when he was with Tarcher Penguin, making him one of my major, major heroes. There is not a publisher out there now who will publish Whitley Strieber, not one. So, unfortunately, Mitch decided to move on from Tarcher Penguin and has been leading an absolutely fascinating life. He's been on Dreamland a number of times. Positive thinking is one of his areas of expertise. Edgar Cayce, How Thoughts Become Reality. I'm just looking through all of the shows we've done with Mitch. The Miracle Club. It's just the other great one that subscribers, you mustn't miss any of these, but especially America's Occult History, which is just brain-bending. It's a wonderful show. Mitch Horowitz, I want to welcome you to Dreamland.
Thank you so much, Whitley. Pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be with you again, Mitch. I must say that I do miss our great days when you were my editor and I could get published because you get it. You've always gotten it.
Thank you. We'll make it happen again. There are great days ahead and you sound terrific and I'm very glad to be here.
Well, great. Well, I know the power of positive thinking and that's why I'm taking this attitude now. Because if anyone can make it happen, it's Mitch Horowitz. And a little later, we're going to talk with Mitch about a remarkable program that he saw at the Guggenheim Museum, starring Diana Pasulka, another friend of Dreamland. She's been on the show many times. Leslie Keene and Ralph Blumenthal from the New York Times were both there. It was an important program. But before we get into that, I'm just looking at Mitch's Facebook page, and what jumped out at me immediately was this sentence: the top 10 conservative rock songs of all time. Your latest on Medium.com, which if you go to Medium.com, you'll find a lot of cool Mitch Horowitz stuff. Okay, Mitch, let's talk about rock and conservative rock. What is conservative rock?
Oh, how interesting you bring that up. Yeah, that's my latest piece. I finished it about 9 hours ago and got some sleep. I'm not a conservative, and many of the musicians who I mentioned in the piece are not conservatives, but there are notable times where rock icons, including the Beatles, the Sex Pistols, the Clash, Bob Dylan, get fed up with one-track thinking, and sometimes they push back in songs that offer conservative sentiments or ideals, or at least critiques of the movements that they're part of. For example, John Lennon was obviously very, very sympathetic to the student protest movements, but he was concerned about using incendiary language or celebrating authoritarian regimes as a tool to social change. Hence, he wrote, if you go carrying pictures of Chairman Mao, you ain't going to make it with anyone anyhow. So Revolution is one of the songs on that list, and I provide musical links to each song. I like independent thinking. I like when people shake up the norms. I like when people play against type. And so I felt those 10 songs deserved special highlighting.
Yeah, and can you tell us about, pick a couple of them that you'd like to talk about, because it's interesting. You know, you specified that you're not a conservative, but at the same time, why did you decide to do this go in this particular direction?
Well, I was listening to the Beatles song Revolution, and I was very touched by it, and I began to think about other songs in that vein. So another song on the list, for example, is a Clash song called Safe European Home. Two members of the band were able to fulfill a lifelong dream of traveling to Jamaica, where they had received inspiration for many of their reggae-based songs, and they found that people were trying to rob them and rip them off left and right. It didn't matter that they were punks. They were sort of subjected to that treatment in a poverty-stricken nation. No aspersion on the nation of Jamaica, which I deeply love, but they wrote about their experience sardonically in the song Safe European Home. Another song on the list is the Dead Kennedys' Holiday in Cambodia. Now, the Dead Kennedys, a band that made a huge impact on me when I was 17 years old, a lifelong impact, They're a hardcore punk band that always inveighs against corporatism and American military power. But like John Lennon, they wanted to point out that the left doesn't do itself any favors by romanticizing authoritarian regimes. So Holiday in Cambodia was a kind of biting critique of college students who tend to romanticize regimes that sometimes are far worse than what they replaced. There's all kinds of songs on there. Another one is the Sex Pistols song Bodies, which is basically an anti-abortion song. Not a position that I personally share, but I felt that the lyrics and the ideas in the song were worth shouting out because people should realize that rock and roll, classic rock, punk is not a unified front when it comes to political questions. And again, I like independent thinking, and I like people who voice the unexpected from time to time, even if it goes against the grain of what their fans may believe. All the more reason to say, look, you know, we have to take a second look at things from time to time. So that's what this list is all about.
Well, it's a most interesting list, and folks, you might think about if in the comments section, the subscribers, what rock songs do you feel might fit on a list like that? On Mitch's Facebook page, which is facebook.com, Mitch Horowitz, number one, MitchHorowitz.1, there are a lot of different comments about this. And so, you know, think about it, because there's all kinds of different levels of political sort of change that are going on right now all over the world, not just in the United States. And, you know, it's worth talking about it, and talking about it through the medium of music is one of the main ways we have always done it. Free Dreamlanders, listen up. Mitch is the lecturer in residence at the Philosophical Research Society, founded by Manly Hall. It's in Los Angeles. Its website is prs.org. That's prs.org. He's going to be speaking there on October the 24th, Gods of the Outsiders, the 25th, Mysterious Beasts and Natural Wonders, which is going to be a load of fun, the 26th, The Miracle Club. He's going to get deeply into just what that all means and how to make that work, because it does. It works for Mitch. Also on the 26th, there's going to be a special event involving the Tarot with Mitch at the Philosophical Research Society. That's prs.org. Click on Lecturer in Residence in order to learn more.
Whitley Strieber became the host of Dreamland in 1998, and he's still the host today. One of the first podcasts, Dreamland has been built into the premier program of its kind, exploring the edge of science and reality. The show's archive on unknowncountry.com dates back to 2004. Dreamland is a treasure unique in the world.
At this point in this commercial, I used to say that you can't subscribe because we are still in our old website, but that has changed at last. UnknownCountry.com's new website is available. Go to UnknownCountry.com and take a look. It is beautiful. It offers a huge archive, weekly chats, a free message board, all kinds of great stuff. Whitley Strieber audiobooks for subscribers, and much, much more. New stuff coming on the site all the time. So go to unknowncountry.com, take a look, and really open your mind. How do you do that? By subscribing and exploring and having a great time.
Earthfiles.com is Linda Moulton Howe's great website, offering news of the edge of science and reality. Keep up with Linda's work every single day on earthfiles.com. A new world is coming. Whitley has just finished his book about what it's like to live with and communicate with the visitors. He's been doing this for the past 30 years, and since 2015, the intensity of it has exploded. Over the next few months, he'll be reading from it for subscribers prior to publication. So be among the first to know what living with them is really like, and what it will be like for more and more of us in the future. A new world, unforgettable.
Mitch is the lecturer in residence at the Philosophical Research Society, founded by Manly Hall. It's in Los Angeles. Its website is
prs.org. That's prs.org. He's going to be speaking there on October the 24th, Gods of the Outsiders, the 25th, Mysterious Beasts and Natural Wonders, which is going to be a load of fun, the 26th, the Miracle Club. He's going to get deeply into just what that all means and how to make that work, because it does. It works for Mitch. Also on the 26th, there's going to be a special event involving the Tarot with Mitch at the Philosophical Research Society. That's prs.org. Click on Lecturer in Residence in order to learn more. We're back. We're talking to Mitch Horowitz, his website, mitchhorowitz.com, his Facebook page. Just search Facebook for Mitch Horowitz, and he'll be at the top of the list. Fascinating life and fascinating man. He's got cool stuff going on his website and his Facebook page pretty much all the time. Also a cool Twitter feed, by the way. Now, Mitch, you know a lot about sexuality and transmutation. Can you tell us a little bit about the book you wrote?
Sure. I have a short new book out called The Power of Sex Transmutation. There are many different teachings, both ancient and modern, that look at sexuality and the sexual urge as not only an innate physical urge, but as a kind of psychical force. You'll find this in Kabbalah, you'll find this in Vedic teachings, in Tantra, in Taoism, and also in contemporary chaos magic, sex magic, and in the book Think and Grow Rich, actually, by Napoleon Hill, which has been a formative influence on me. In chapter 13 of Think and Grow Rich, in 1937, Napoleon Hill wrote that there is a mysterious power, which he referred to as sex transmutation, which I expand upon in the book. And Hill's thesis was very simple, very basic, very practical, and I thought it deserved further airing and further exploration. He maintained that sexuality is a kind of universal life force. It's the force of life wishing to express itself through us. Most often, we respond to the sexual urge either through physical satisfaction or through the propagation of the species. We wouldn't be here without it. But Hill maintained that the sexual urge can also be put at the back of our energies for whatever project we are pursuing, including something of a completely non-sexual nature, like a work of art or a piece of writing or a job interview or whatever you can select that you're working on that's really important to you at a given moment. And he said that when you experience the sexual urge through a mental act, you can actually redirect your thoughts away from thoughts of sexual pleasure towards the effort that you're putting into whatever project you may be working on. And through that mental act, through that act of mental alchemy or transmutation, you will place this universal life urge behind your efforts, and it will improve your enthusiasm, your mental acuity, your insight, your intuition. And it's something very simple and very private. Just when you feel the sexual urge at a moment of your own choosing, you use your mind to divert away from thoughts of sexual expression or sexual pleasure and towards the project that you're working on. And you will receive the benefit of that universal life force, so to speak, behind the efforts that you're putting into your task. This doesn't mean abstaining from sexuality. This doesn't mean changing your intimate life. This isn't something you have to broadcast or doing to other people. It's just a personal, intimate choice that you can use your thoughts to shift your wish for sexual satisfaction towards the completion of a project. It's just an experiment. It's just something to try. And it's such a simple, simple way of experimenting with these teachings of sex magic that we sometimes hear about, but that can seem very esoteric. I wanted to demystify the process as best as I'm able and render it in language that is really practical, really simple, really accessible. And that's what this book, The Power of Sex Transmutation, is about.
You know, it reminded me a lot of the material about sexual transmutation in the ancient Chinese text, The Secret of the Golden Flower. I wonder if that was one of your inspirations.
Actually, my inspirations have come from a variety of ancient sources, including ancient Chinese and Taoist teachings, as you just referenced, including tantric teachings, and including contemporary sex magic, which was popularized to probably the greatest extent by Aleister Crowley, the British magician. He certainly wasn't the only one. Napoleon Hill is another. Pascal Beverly Randolph is another. There have been a variety of modern figures who have tried to update these teachings, I think with some success. And the version that I write about in The Power of Sex Transmutation is one version among many. But I selected it because I thought it was the simplest. I thought it was something that the individual could do in private. It's something that doesn't require a partner. It's just an individual choice, an individual experiment. And I tried to render it in terms that are very simple.
Yeah, and you indeed, if you use it, and you know, I've been working in this area for a very long time because deep inside the Gurdjieff system, there is a lot of material also about using sexual energy for transmutation. I believe you've been involved in that, so you might know this. I'm not sure.
Yes.
Go good.
Please. Oh no, but your listeners wouldn't know. Yeah. I mean, you and I were both involved in the work for several years, and when you're involved in the Gurdjieff work, regardless of whether you're in a group at the present time or not, it stays with you for the rest of your life. It changes you. And Gurdjieff himself wrote a great deal about the extent to which the desire for sexual expression drives our lives. It's a huge force within the scheme of what it means to be human. But so often we neglect these things and we think of sexuality as something that's only a matter of propagation or only a matter of sexual pleasure or satisfaction. And we don't realize that it's a universal force. And I think that we can use it through the agencies of our mind in ways that we might not suspect.
Now, the thing about sexuality is that there's a deeper energy underneath it.
Yes. Yeah,
can you tell us a little bit, give your impression of what that means?
Well, the theory is, and it's always difficult to explain these things, you know, because one is using metaphor for experiences that we don't really understand. But if I can use this language, I would say that sexuality is a kind of universal life force. Without it, we literally wouldn't be here. And sexuality is behind so much of what goes on in our world. Many people pursue projects, both positive and negative. They pursue new inventions. They drag us into wars based on sexual desire. Quite frankly, a lot of people are driven to become more sexually attractive or magnetic, to attract a mate, to retain a mate. They're driven toward various definitions of success by this urgency that we all feel to express sexuality in our lives. And it's always present behind all world events. I mean, look, one of our presidents, Bill Clinton, was dragged through impeachment because of a need to express sexuality in a way that may have been corrupt and inappropriate, but that is present in all of us. It can be used very destructively, or it can be used positively. Obviously, in consensual relationships, it's used positively, but it doesn't just have to stop with intimate relationships. It can be harnessed and used in ways that place these creative energies, so to speak, at the back of our efforts. And in experimenting with this material myself, I have found that it does place greater enthusiasm, energy, mental acuity behind what you're doing.
Yes.
Napoleon Hill made the observation that sometimes we'll talk about magnetism or charisma. And he felt that those are really euphemisms, in a sense, for sexuality or sexual energy. And that if you're talking to a salesperson and that salesperson seems particularly persuasive, there is a expression of sexuality going on in that exchange, even though overtly it's just over commerce. And very often people will be using this sexual energy without even knowing it. A salesman may say, well, gee, I've always had a way with customers. Well, What way? Sometimes this sexual energy is underlying the exchange that's going on without the individuals involved even knowing it. So this is a way of consciously trying to use that, consciously trying to exercise that in a productive, non-destructive way to enhance your personal efforts.
You know, you remind me of a time I was in a car dealership with Ann in Texas when we needed a new car because we were doing a lot more driving, having moved down from New York. And we went into a Chevy dealership, and here comes this guy, about 6 feet tall in a big cowboy hat, walks up, not to me, but to Ann, and says, "I'm going to give you your car today." And she was, next thing I knew, she was buying a
all
Chevy, and I said, "Ann, we got to go." We got out of there. I said, "I don't want a Chevrolet." She said, "Well, why not?" I said, "Well, it's the guy."
"Yeah."
"What guy?" She says, "You know," I said, "it's the guy selling you sex, not cars."
Right.
Of course, she got furious then, but it was true. We ended up with a Beamer. Not that I dislike Chevrolets. I love some of them. I wish they still made the Volt, but they stopped that beautiful car.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, look, in The Secret of the Golden Flower, which is one of my main sources of spiritual exploration, and folks, this is an ancient Chinese text that's been translated two times, one based on was by a German translator, then translated it into English, and has an introduction by Carl Jung. The other one is a more, I would say, artistic or more poetic translation. But the one that is not so poetic is quite useful in that you can understand some, but not all, of what's being said. Now, one of the things in it that is, I think, quite fascinating is the material on the 100 days of abstinence.
Yes.
This is a period of time where you are supposedly completely abstain from all sexual activity while engaging in the various meditation practices, and it opens you to a higher level. Is there anything real in that?
I think there is something real to it. This was a practice that was also written about by Henry David Thoreau and even Benjamin Franklin. They didn't have access to a translation of The Secret of the Golden Flower at the time, but they arrived at it through their own agencies. And if you read Walden, you'll see Thoreau actually making reference to this. I have experimented with abstinence, but that's not my program. I frankly find abstinence a very difficult road to hoe, and I don't think it's the only way that you can use some of these esoteric teachings. So the approach that I write about doesn't involve abstinence, but just individual choice. There are just certain select moments where you feel that sexual urge, which is universal, and you redirect it. But I do know people who are working with that esoteric teaching and that magic, and they're very enthusiastic about it.
Well, it's interesting. I am not, I have no wife now, and so I am celibate by nature, because I had a 45-year marriage. Ann is the only woman I've ever known intimately, and that's it for me. You know, I've had my fun. So, in any case, I can kind of do this on, you know, without, it's just my life.
And right.
So, but, you know, free Dreamlanders, we got to take a little break here. And, hey, you guys mostly, I mean, there's lots of places to listen to this show. There's 70,000 listeners on the average a week in free Dreamland. And, you know, we get maybe 3 or 4 or 5 subscriptions a week out of that. And that's not right. You have a responsibility to yourself and actually to the website and to me and to this whole effort that is going on. And in a little while, we're going to be talking to Mitch about the changes in the whole way the UFO phenomenon is being addressed in the world. This is the core here. This is the center. This is where it begins. And so you should certainly support this site. So go to unknowncountry.com and click on the subscribe tab now, then come back to the show. We'll be right back. Mitch is the lecturer in residence at the Philosophical Research Society, founded by Manly Hall. It's in Los Angeles. Its website is p PRS.org. That's PRS.org. He's going to be speaking there on October the 24th, Gods of the Outsiders, the 25th, Mysterious Beasts and Natural Wonders, which is going to be a load of fun, the 26th, the Miracle Club. He's going to get deeply into just what that all means and how to make that work, because it does. It works for Mitch. Also on the 26th, there's going to be a special event involving the Tarot with Mitch at the Philosophical Research Society. That's PRS.org. Click on Lecturer in Residence in order to learn more.
As a subscriber of Dreamland for many years, it's been an incredible adventure and truly a Rosetta Stone for so many of the experiences that all of your listeners have had. Please join us. It's a fantastic ride. But I will say that certainly Dreamland does reflect something that I've always known, that man's mind mirrors a universe that mirrors man's mind. And no other place will you get this truth than on Dreamland. Come join us.
Some of the most thrilling, mind-opening interviews ever recorded are in the Dreamland Archive. Open your mind to Sir Lawrence Gardner's brilliant vision of the past. Listen to Russell Targ's phenomenal insights about ESP. Be inspired by Dr. Eben Alexander's stunning near-death experience. Listen to an actual recording from a plane as it was attacked by a gigantic flying disc. Be transported to a new level of inner grace with Whitley Strieber's meditations. Enjoy The Communion, Transformation, Majestic, Secret School, and Superstorm audiobooks, and so much more. The UnknownCountry.com subscriber section, as little as 10 cents a day. Priceless.
We're talking to Mitch Horowitz. You can find him on Facebook. His website is MitchHorowitz.com, where you can find lots and lots of articles that Mitch has written. You can find information about his books. And, you know, Mitch is a very deep, deep presence in what I would call the world's esoteric community at this point. Mitch knows an awful lot of things and understands a lot. He understands esotericism very deeply. And so it's always such an honor to have Mitch on the show. Now, Mitch, you know, the last time we talked together, well, time before last, actually, we talked about occult America. And I noticed that you have written a book or done something about Neville Goddard.
Yes.
Can you talk about Neville Goddard and let our listeners know who he was and why you would pay so much attention to him?
Neville has probably been the primary spiritual influence in my life. He was a British Barbadian mystic who lived and worked in America for most of his career. He was born in 1905, died in West Hollywood in 1972. And Neville promulgated one basic teaching, which is that your imagination is God, and that everything that you experience is your own emotionalized thoughts and mental pictures pushed out into the world. And he believed that this message was encoded in a way symbolically within scripture, and that every time in scripture you come upon a reference to God in Old Testament, New Testament, you are encountering a symbolical metaphor for the forces of your own imagination. And Neville, in his mystical reading of scripture, particularly the New Testament, believed that scripture really tells a story that is not historic, but that is a symbolical unfolding of your own progress as an aware being, and that as you come to use and understand the formative or causative powers of your mind, you will eventually come face to face with the fact that you are the creator, you are the divine clothed in flesh, and that your mind is literally God of scripture. And Neville argued for this in such a compelling fashion in hundreds of lectures and books and presentations that he delivered over the course of his life. And I've written a new book about Neville called Magician of the Beautiful. And in Magician of the Beautiful, I ask where this man came from, how he came into his ideas, and I try to evaluate his ideas and why they work. My experience has been that they do work, although they can be, the workings themselves can be very mysterious. There can be a real time interval between thought and actuality. And the book serves as both an introduction to Neville for people who don't know him, and also serves, I hope, to deepen the practice of people like me who have been committed to Neville's ideas for many years.
Well, you know, it's very well worth getting into. You speak of committed for many, many years. I personally had never heard of him before I saw your book. So,
oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
He was an underground figure for many, many years. A lot of people hadn't heard of Neville. He was a strikingly handsome man. He looked like a film star. He looked like John Barrymore. But he very rarely permitted his picture to be taken. And when he died in 72, he was still speaking and writing, but he was in relative obscurity. I hadn't heard of him until 2003. I was interviewing the Major League Baseball pitcher Barry Zito, and Barry used Neville and Ernest Holmes and other metaphysical teachers as part of his training regimen, and he was shocked when I told him I had never heard of Neville. I got off the phone with Barry. I got one of Neville's books called Resurrection, which he wrote in 1966, and I just fell into it. I fell into it. And he has a huge following online today, and yet there's still many people who have not heard of him. He was kind of an underground figure, kind of a mysterious figure during the course of his life, but absolutely remarkable man. And his writings, Whitley, they are just simplicity itself. He writes with such clarity and elegance and beauty, and no matter how often he restated his basic thesis, it always sounded fresh. So when people get into Neville, they very often fall into him, as I did.
Well, yeah, and I'm going to, too, because, you know, your book has opened a door to me that I didn't even know was closed.
It's fascinating.
which is so exciting because, you know, there's something very real here, folks. There has been a kind of movement where we went through a long period of believing that wishes could make it so, and it's not quite like that.
Yes,
but it really, there is something there that works. What, Mitch, if you could, you remember those books about, you know, wish and make it so, the sorts of books that were so popular for a few years?
Yeah.
What was wrong there, and what actually does work?
Well, what's interesting is all those popular books about wishing and making it so, they have a certain instinct, and I think their basic instinct is right, but too often those authors sidestepped the question of suffering. They sidestepped the question of illness. They sidestepped what we go through in this life, in which our bodies decline and we experience demise. And I always found that sort of cheap. You can't sidestep issues of chronic illness, issues of poverty, natural disasters that plunge whole nations into chaos. And I believe that we experience many, many laws and forces within this framework that we live within. It's possible that awareness or consciousness is the ultimate arbiter of reality. But in our daily five sensory lives, most of us are very, very far away from that truth. And the fact is, we experience the effects of all kinds of laws and forces within the mixture of joys and suffering that life inevitably presents to all of us. We still have to experiment with this question of thought causation and figure out where it fits in and how far we're capable of going with it, at least within the general framework that most of us occupy. And as we begin to experiment, we find truths, we find testimony, we also find scientific data that supports an ever-increasing definition of the powers of the mind. We're seeing extraordinary things today in placebo studies, in neuroplasticity, in psychical research, in quantum theory, things that we couldn't have dreamt of two generations ago. And the individual has a part to play in this. The individual has a role to play in this. We have to experiment with these things in our own lives and try to figure out where we detect symmetries. So I think this testimony is not imaginary. I think it's very important, and it comports with some very mysterious and important things that are also going on in the sciences today. And I want the individual to feel that whatever circumstances you're facing, you are never fully without resources. Our thoughts have a deeper dimension than we may understand, and we may be a long way away from the awareness that Neville Goddard came to. I certainly am. But being a long way away from the center of things doesn't mean that we can't begin to take a single step. And I very much want people to experiment with these things.
Free Dreamlanders, we're going to take a brief break here. We'll be right back. Now, how will you go about doing that, working toward it? Because there's got to be some kind of infrastructure, and you run the risk, obviously, of nobody showing up. I mean, from their side, that's happened before. Years ago, the United States Senate, a Senate committee became convinced that the Grays were going to show up in New Mexico and went out there with a whole bunch of equipment and people, and they said, Whitley, you must come because you're going to miss this. And I said, I'm not coming because it ain't going to happen. And it didn't. Mm. And afterwards, some of them said, well, if you had come, it would have happened. And I thought, no, it's not like that. But where are we here? Because you're not the only person who has the message that this should happen in 2020. But you're one of the few that has confirmatory evidence that there is a presence there communicating with you. So what is your next step?
Do you remember the great Lawrence Gardner? Well, I certainly do remember his great, extraordinary books and his incredible vision of the past, the true past of mankind. Did you know that in the unknowncountry.com subscriber section, you'll find over 15 special interviews and dreamlands with Lawrence Gardner dating back to 2004. In order to find them, all you have to do is go to unknowncountry.com, put the name Lawrence Gardner, L-A-U-R-E-N-C-E Gardner, into the search engine on the upper right of the homepage, and they will all pop up. If you are a Dreamland subscriber, you can listen to any one of them by simply clicking on it. You'll be asked for your username and password, and you can start to listen right away. If you're not a subscriber, this is how to get information about the lost secrets of Jesus, the truth about Moses, the extraordinary truth about Moses, about white powder gold, what it is, how it works, incredible material only on unknowncountry.com and only in the amazing unknowncountry.com archive. Subscribe to unknowncountry.com today. It's just $12.95 for 3 months, and it will feed your mind. Don't miss this enormous and beautiful resource. Click on that subscribe tab on unknowncountry.com today.
We're talking to Mitch Horowitz. His website, mitchhorowitz.com. You can find him on Facebook. You can get his books through his website or go to Amazon and just input Mitch Horowitz, because there is a lot there. Talk about eclectic. That is very definitely there. Now, one of the things one of the visitors said to a Close Encounter witness many years ago was extremely telling. It was, we rearrange atoms. Now, the world is held in place by something called the strong force, the nuclear force in nature. But what's fascinating about the world is that it is 99.99 to the 25th of 30th power empty space. Mm-hmm. In other words, this is mostly not here. It just looks like it's here.
Yes.
And that, I think, is the door into what you're talking about, because I don't think the visitors use technology to do this. And I've seen them do it. I've seen them walk through walls. I've seen them change their shape right before my eyes. And I think it's done with thought.
Yes.
And I think that's the thought you're talking about.
Yes.
So can you tell us a little bit about are there methods like of meditation that enable us to kind of engage more deeply at this level, so that at least our wishes are reaching the right place in our lives or not?
Yes, I believe there really are concrete methods, and it's amazing to me that statement, we rearrange atoms. I would say that that is empirically true. We can state that as a plain fact because of the material that's come out of quantum physics over the past 80 years. And not quantum physics alone. There are other fields, including serious psychical research, that have affirmed this as well. But if a scientist takes a measurement of a subatomic particle in a quantum lab, we have found again and again over hundreds of experiments that that particle, until the measurement is actually taken by a sentient observer, that particle exists in a wave state. It only collapses and it's localized, so to speak, to a particle state when somebody makes a decision to look. That's an astounding discovery that upends everything we were raised to believe. And sometimes the individual will look at that data and say to him or herself, well, hey, that's all well and good in the particle lab, but in my macro life, there's only one table. There's not multiple tables. There's not infinite tables. There's not space. There's solidity. If I stub my toe, I feel pain. So what does any of this mean to me in the macro world? And I write about this in my book, The Miracle Club, and further in Magician of the Beautiful. The fact is, it is possible that our five senses, as we know them, are nothing other than a system of measurement, not much different from the instruments that the quantum physicist is using in the particle lab. The difference is the instruments that the quantum physicist is using are instruments of much finer resolution than our coarsened senses. And it's possible that when we're using our senses, it's almost like panning back a camera. You see less and less of what's actually going on. But that doesn't mean that it's not going on. It just means that we're not able to access it from our usual vantage point. So my thesis is that the reason why thoughts correspond to reality is not so much that we're manifesting things. I don't favor the term manifest. I use the term select. It could be that through our perspective and that through our emotionalized thoughts, we are actually taking measurements and making selections of things that we are going to experience. And the question is, how do we do it purposefully? How do we do it consciously so that we're not just being blown around like, you know, little paper boats on a pond somewhere? If you can go into a state of meditation or a state of deep relaxation, and if you can concoct a mental scene that feels emotionally persuasive to you and vividly real, that seems to be the method that has produced the greatest fruit in terms of the mind consciously producing circumstance. That was the method that Neville Goddard worked with. That's the method that I work with. I do it at least twice a day. And it's a question of concocting a little scene that feels emotionally persuasive. And emotional persuasion can be a very difficult thing. It can help to do this when you're in a state of very, very deep relaxation, or to use that relaxed state that you find yourself in just before you're falling to sleep at night, which sleep researchers refer to as the hypnagogic state. It is a time of day when our rational defenses are down. And when our rational defenses are down, we're more easily able to persuade ourselves of something that we might push back against during our normal waking hours. So I usually use that time of day just before falling to sleep at night and just when waking up in the morning to use visualization, because that's a time where we have cognition, but we are not as possessed of rational perspective as we are during our normal waking hours, and that can actually be used to our benefit.
You know, that's really very interesting because, you know, that also, it reminds me of Robert Monroe's body asleep, mind awake state, which I have learned to enter and have entered many times, but unfortunately for me, I can't do out-of-body travel without the help of the visitors. I don't think they trust me, and I don't blame them. I wouldn't trust me either if I could get out on my own.
But, well,
go ahead.
This question of letting the door of the psyche sort of fly off its hinges, so to speak, is a tough one. You know, entering a state that's sufficiently relaxed so that you can try to work either with lucid dreaming or out-of-body travel or just visualization, it can be very difficult for some of us. It's difficult for me. William James wrote, lamented how difficult it was for him. For some people, it comes more naturally. But if you have kind of a hyper-rational intellect, which can be a good thing, it can require greater effort. It's been a struggle for me over the course of my life because Neville always talks about entering this effortless state. That's very hard for me. So it doesn't come naturally to me, but it can be such a wonderful, wonderful experience. And it's something I really encourage people to experiment with.
How would you go about experimenting with it?
Well, the chief way I was just describing is to go into a state of almost drowsiness. Neville used to do this at 3 o'clock in the afternoon after he ate lunch. I do it at night just as I'm drifting to sleep. When you're in that state in which you're hovering between sleepfulness and wakefulness, you can experience a very dreamlike state, but you still have cognition. You still have control over your cognition. And that's when you can direct your thoughts, direct your mental images in whatever way represents an ideal for you. I think what's happening is we are selecting circumstances in those states, and it's something that the individual has to experiment with. Psychical researchers have also found that drowsy state, when we hover between sleep or wakefulness, is prime time, so to speak, for ESP-related activity. So that they've found within psychical research labs, a whole range of possibilities seem to open to the individual when you're in that state of very relaxed sensory deprivation. So that's the time to experiment, in my experience.
That's very interesting because it's, you know, as I said before, I've used the Monroe Institute, the Robert Monroe tapes, which help you get into this state. And I went to a gateway at the Monroe Institute and learned more about the process from Monroe himself while he was still alive. I gave him a galley of communion. He said,
wow.
He read it. He said, you know, you understand this is going to get you into a lot of trouble. I said, what do you mean? I was completely clueless. He said, oh, this is going to blow up in the face of the world. I said, I'm stunned. Well, I can't believe what I'm hearing. He said, well, you just wait and see.
That's fascinating.
It did. It did. Yeah. Oh, he knew a lot of things, that guy.
Yeah. Yeah. He was remarkable.
Now, one of the things that's fascinating about Monroe, and this leads into a question for you, obviously, or wouldn't be mentioning it, is that when he had in his early life the long period of out-of-body experiences that he chronicles in his various books, he was living in a house with a pyramid-shaped roof. Yeah. Now, I have never seen in any of your books anything about the power of geometric shapes, and I'm taking a kind of flyer here because I have a funny feeling that because of who you are, you might have thought about this.
That's interesting. I have thought about it, but I've never personally experimented with it. I was in Egypt in February of this year where I'm shooting a film with the director, Ronnie Thomas. It's a documentary about the occult book, The Kabbalion, sort of affirming some of the ideas found within The Kabbalion, which are a leaf out of some ancient Hermetic teachings that circulated in Egypt in late antiquity. And what you've said has inspired me because I've never worked with pyramidic or geometric shapes, and I'm going to do so, actually. It has been something on my mind, but that's one experiment I have not yet attempted. So I'll come back on a future show and we could talk about how that goes.
Yeah, because, you know, I was once projected out of my body into the pyramid at Giza. I think that's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I really shot up into the sky at breakneck speed, and it scared me so badly, I found out myself back in my body. I don't talk about it much because I'm not sure if it was a dream or not, because it happened in the middle of the night. But I've always said to people who are easily capable, who out-of-body travel, who can control it themselves, to try going to the pyramid out-of-body and see what happens. So far, none of them have simply disappeared, but, you know, there's... go ahead.
Yeah, I'll share a personal story from Egypt, which I haven't talked about much publicly. When when Ronnie and I were there in February, we got to enter a very, very deep chamber in the Valley of Kings, which is ordinarily closed off. And we were granted access to this chamber, not because the Egyptian authorities love us, but because we paid them. And we went deep into this chamber. It was very private, and there was an enormous bas relief of a bull on one of the walls. And the bull in ancient Egypt, as in other cultures, has always been a symbol of fertility and sexuality. And the guide who I was with, who was not English-speaking, invited me to place my hands on the bull, which I viewed as a tremendous privilege because you can't touch these ancient monuments, and they shouldn't be touched too often because we obviously don't want these things to erode. But I was given this opportunity, and I accepted it. And when I placed my hands on this enormous bas relief of a bull, all I can report to you is that I felt a true, true electricity shoot through my body. It was one of the most extraordinary experiences of my life. And looking back on it, you know, this was about 7 months ago. In the period since then, I've written this book, The Power of Sex Transmutation, and done other things in this field. And it probably stemmed from that experience. It was an experience, again, you know, you could call it subjective, you could call it imaginary. It certainly didn't feel imaginary. It felt very palpable and very real. And if I can offer any empiricism, all I can say is that in the months since then, sexuality has become more of a focus in my life. I've written this book, and other things have happened to me in that area of life. It was an unforgettable experience.
Wow, I'm glad I asked that question. That's absolutely fascinating. Now, you know, someone else who had a similar experience, I believe, as I recall, was Linda Moulton Howe, when mm-hmm. she was, I believe, on the island where the cave where St. John supposedly wrote the Book of Revelation is located.
Yes.
She had a very similar experience of that kind of earth energy. And, you know, the Egyptians knew it profoundly in the pyramid text in the Pyramid of Unas, as interpreted and translated by Susan Bryn Morrow in her book, The Dawning Moon of the Mind. It talks about a great deal, and I say specifically this because there is a awful lot of very, very poor hieroglyphic translation out there, primarily done by Eurocentric scholars who assume mm-hmm. that the Egyptians were all a bunch of primitive idiots and mm-hmm. translate the texts accordingly. Anyway, the role of the spine in transmitting and collecting earth energy is very much a part of the pyramid text.
Yes.
In fact, the first place that chakras are ever mentioned is in that text, in the seven serpents that surround the serpent of the spine, which oddly enough, their hieroglyph for them is translated Taniter, which obviously became Tantra, but tantric scholars don't date the origin of Tantra from that distance. They think it started much later.
Yes, and you beat me to it. The spine represents nothing so much as the serpent, as you referenced. And of course, in Genesis 3, we have a serpent bringing wisdom, bringing awareness to Eve. A controversial text, but that's really the beginning of human awakefulness, human sentience. And
right.
Every culture, from the Maya to the Egyptians to the ancient Hebrews to many others, have used the serpent as a symbol of knowledge. And this, of course, appears in the work of Carl Jung, and people have made comparisons between the serpent and the DNA strand. It's absolutely fascinating, but I think our primordial ancestors encrypted so much, symbolized so much in the symbol of the serpent. And it appears in every culture, separated by great time and distance. It's really one of the great esoteric mysteries that has been left for us.
Exactly. And it's a powerful mystery because, and it's also, the serpent has been demonized, and that's
yes.
very unfortunate because that's taking us away from our own power, stealing our own power from us. We'll talk about that a little bit more in just a moment, Free Dreamlanders.
When should you subscribe to UnknownCountry.com? How about right now? Go to UnknownCountry.com and click on the subscribe tab on the masthead. We offer subscriptions either by credit card or PayPal, either automatic renewal or annual or longer subscriptions without auto-renew. Plus, it's easy to cancel if you wish. Do it right in your account.
And do we ever need you right now? And do you ever need us? The new unknowncountry.com is beautiful. It is fully functional. The whole archive is working. It's full of amazing stuff. Plus, this is the only place like it in the world. Keep it going. It's up to you. Go to unknowncountry.com. You know what you have to do. It's only a few pennies a day. It's not a big sacrifice, but it means an awful lot.
There are hundreds of charitable organizations in the world, but you have to have a sharp eye to be sure your money is going to where it's needed and not into the pockets of overpaid administrators. That's why Whitley Strieber and UnknownCountry.com support the Mercy Corps. It's non-sectarian, it's lean and efficient, and it goes everywhere on earth that people are in need. When you contribute, you can be sure that most of your dollar goes right to the homeless, the starving, and the desperate. Go to Unknown Country and click on the Mercy Corps Foundation ad on the left side of your homepage. A $10 gift can put food on a child's plate and shoes on his feet. Unknown Country and Whitley Strieber receive no compensation from the Mercy Corps.
Whitley Strieber's nonfiction is magical, powerful, and thought-provoking. From communion to the afterlife revolution, there is no body of work like it in the world. Nothing even approaches it. And not only that, his wonderful fiction, from The Wolfen to his latest novel, New, offers reading and listening entertainment that you will never forget. And where do you find all this in one place? At Strieber.com. That's where. Every Whitley Strieber book available for sale is there. So don't wait. Go to Strieber.com and start exploring. There's only one Whitley and only one place to find all his work. Strieber.com. Earthfiles.com is Linda Moulton Howe's great website, offering news of the edge of science and reality. Keep up with Linda's work every single day on earthfiles.com.
We're talking to Mitch Horowitz. His website, mitchhorowitz.com, if you go to Amazon and you click on, you search on Mitch Horowitz, you'll find all of his books, and there are so many of them, and they are so good that I think that rather than promoting a specific book, that we're better off with you searching for them and visit him on Facebook, join him on Twitter. Mitch gets around in social media. He knows what he's doing with social media. And we're going to, of course, I think that we're going to promote on the show The Power of Sex Transmutation because it's just come out. But, and it's a wonderful book, by the way, and it refers indirectly to a lot of what we've been talking about just now with regard to ancient Egypt. In the next half hour, we're going to be talking about the occult and also Ouija boards and the mystery of the Illuminati, all of which Mitch knows a great deal about. But right now, I want to go back to a couple of other things that I've wanted for a long time to talk to you about. We are now once again awaiting the end, the apocalypse. Only this time it looks like it might be real. I know you've written about this habit or this human expectation of awaiting the end. The Christianity, after all, was a millennial religion. They expected the end of the world to occur soon.
Yes.
And it didn't exactly the way they thought. But within 300 years of the death of Jesus Christ, their world, as they understood and knew it, had ended. The Roman Empire collapsed.
Yes, yes.
So what are we up against now with the environmental situation, and what can we do about it? Can we do anything within ourselves that might help the situation?
Well, it's an interesting question. The end of the Mayan calendar cycle, 2012, came and went, and there were some people who woke up the next day and said, look, you know, we're still here, but there can be a gestation period in which things unfold in ways that are not necessarily disclosing to us immediately. And you're making a wonderful point that with the coming of Christ, of course, the world as we know it didn't end, but there was a seismic social shift to the extent that we really regard post-Christianity as the period of modernity, you know, to a very great extent. Humanity underwent a tremendous shift away from an empire and temple-based model of life toward different experiments, both in inherited aristocracy, fitful attempts at democracy. I think it's almost impossible to avoid that our generation is standing on some sort of a precipice. And I'm cautious when I say that because every generation, to some greater or lesser degree, feels like it's on a precipice, and some really were. You know, the World War I generation felt like it was on a precipice, and there was good reason for them to believe that. But
yeah, I would say.
Yeah, I have no question in my mind that our way of life is going to change in 20 years. If we're going to stick around, our way of life is going to change in 20 years. And I don't know precisely what that means, but I think we live in an age where it's impossible intellectually to engage in climate denial. We are facing some sort of a profound transformation in climate. And I don't know what policy solutions need to be applied to this. I mean, there's all kinds of ideas out there, and I'm interested in all of them, but I'm only a layman when it comes to this material. And I'm also a participant in the global economy that creates all these problems. I have a recycling bin that's overflowing right now with disposable materials. And every day when I take out the recycling, which goes God knows where, I say to myself, you know, I'm as bad as anybody else. I'm not doing a thing individually to try to improve the situation. But I am struck with fear from time to time by the disposability of our culture and how many disposable vessels and appliances and other things I use. And that bargain is just breaking down. That bargain is simply breaking down. For many years, the United States kind of had a rough deal with the rest of the world. You guys produce lots of cheap appliances. We'll pay for them and import them. We'll throw out our microwave oven every 2 years and we'll buy something new. Well, with deindustrialization in our own country and a crisis in good jobs, factory jobs, industrial jobs, so on and so forth, that crisis is breaking down. We can't just keep importing cheap appliances and cheap goods from the rest of the world and expecting that the rest of the world, the Philippines and other nations, are going to keep taking our garbage. That's just impossible. So we're going to need a new bargain. I don't know what that bargain is, but there's no ignoring it. I don't feel, frankly, that I've done anything in my personal life to try to make the situation better. So I admit that with some degree of embarrassment. I'm still living in the same haze that most Americans are living under.
Yeah, because the way our world works doesn't work anymore. We can't live in a plastic universe. It's over. We're in a situation where I think, you know, the visitors have been, since the beginning of my relationship with them, absolutely obsessed about this. Yeah. This is what they care about the most, is our survival. So we're in a situation. A couple of weeks ago, we had a guest on Dreamland called Starfire Tor during the Amazon fires, who claimed that she could make rain happen. And she's, you know, she seems completely off the wall, but the problem is Anne and I actually experienced time slips and things that she described while in her presence, and provable. I mean, we actually nailed them down. I won't go into it all now because our subscribers, my listeners know about this, but as far-fetched as it seems, some of the things that she does actually work. And, of course, there were people working all around the world on this fire because it was so dangerous. And, oddly enough, right that week when it became a big news story, the rainy season started early in the Amazon, and most of the fires are gone. Now, what might that mean in terms of saving ourselves? Because our planet's falling apart, and that's just the beginning. We're going to be desperate. And, you know, you talk about altering your own life by the power of the mind. Is it possible, Mitch, for us to band together massively, not just 10 people or 50 people, but millions of us, and direct our minds to the preservation and healing of our planet. And if that is possible, how would it work? I bet you've thought about this.
Yes, I do believe it's possible. I do believe it's possible. We as a human species are profoundly fractious. People are thinking about their own lives, thinking about their own needs. I certainly am, all the time. So it is difficult for us as a human species to shift into a kind of generational mindset like the one you've been describing. But I do have many friends and colleagues within the Transcendental Meditation movement, and they have assembled data that demonstrates that when you can concentrate a group of meditators, in this case it's Transcendental Meditation, within a certain geographic area, desirable things happen. Crime goes down. Stress-related illness goes down. They sometimes refer to this as the Maharishi effect after the founder of Transcendental Meditation. This data is obviously controversial, but it's also extremely important because it could demonstrate in hardcore terms an empiricism to back a kind of group mind. The Greeks referred to nous as this kind of great overmind we all participate in. Ralph Waldo Emerson called it the oversoul. Swedenborg called it divine influx. Napoleon Hill called it infinite mind. This idea has always been with us, and I think that we as a species do participate in some kind of nous or overmind. This was also an Egyptian idea. And it's possible, Whitley, it's possible that we're undergoing this change right now as global warming, climate change becomes a matter of urgency for more and more individuals. I have a friend who lives in the borough of Queens here in New York City who lives near the East River. And he's been saying to me seriously that he feels that he and his family might have to purchase property on some kind of higher ground. And that might have seemed like a joke 20 years ago. It doesn't seem like a joke today. What's important is that we as a species be able to think with some sort of comport. Maybe there's some sort of group activity or meditation or time of day that we can all participate in thought. I have a little informal thing that I call the Miracle Club that occurs at 3 p.m. Eastern every day, and I ask people who are interested to just join me in a few moments of silent meditation at 3 p.m. Eastern. They can even write to me or drop me an email asking me to hold in mind some prayer or some ethical desire they have, and I will do so. So there probably are little efforts like this going on all over the world, and these little efforts may become our life raft.
All right, I've got one for you right now. This show is a huge podcast. It has many, many, many thousands of listeners, but very few of them will come and subscribe, meaning it, because we try to do this without taking advertising and getting involved in all of that, all of those that clicks and cookies following people and so on and so forth. And we're failing, basically. People just won't do it. They just won't do it. Help us.
Yes, I will. I will. First of all, it's funny you mention that because I'm the same way. I'm a terrible capitalist. People send me emails all the time from all over the world, and I always have marketing folk coming to me and saying, great, have you saved those emails? And the answer is inevitably, no, I haven't saved them. I suspect it's a mixture of laziness and virtue. You know, it's laziness because I just don't feel like it, and it's virtue because I don't feel like if people write to me with a question or with some need, I don't want them to feel that their name is getting put on a list somewhere. So I'm
I understand
stuff.
That.
Yeah, and so we both have this in common. But what I will do is for the next 3 days at 3 p.m. Eastern, starting today, Friday, Saturday, I will meditate on that for you because I think it's very important that we step up and we support the media that we need and that we believe in. You know, people complain all the time about mainstream media and how it doesn't support their needs or their view of the world or what have you. Well, Dreamland does. So if you don't support it in some way, it's going to go away.
That's right.
I will meditate on that at 3 p.m. Eastern. I invite Dreamland listeners to join with me. I'll do it for the next 3 days consecutively.
Excellent. Thank you. And listeners, you heard what he said. Free listeners, let's get on the stick and do this. And incidentally, if you do subscribe for a year, you can send send subscribers at unknowncountry.com your physical mailing address, and we will send you a copy of the original version of the key signed by me. This is not the version that Mitch published. It's the version that I published many years before. But still, it's a collector's item. And I think that, you know, there's, I have a few left and not all that many, maybe a couple hundred is all. When they're gone, they're gone. So take advantage now. Do it now. Free Dreamlanders, thank you so much as always for being with us. And I do hope you graduate and become subscribers to this wonderful journey that we are all on together. Next up with Mitch, we're going to get into a little bit more deeply an analysis of the occult. We're going to be talking about things like Ouija boards and the Illuminati and things like that, and what exactly all of this is and what the power of it is, if any. Thank you again, Free Dreamlanders, for being with us. Subscribers, we'll just keep right on. We're talking to Mitch Horowitz. His website, mitchhorowitz.com. You can find him easily on Facebook. You can go to Amazon. He's got many, many books out. And you can't go wrong with a Mitch Horowitz book. It just depends on what you want. The power of sex transmutation, for example, I think is a very, very important and powerful book because it leads into a new kind of freedom. And when you read it, you'll understand what I mean. So, Free Dreamlanders, goodbye. Subscribers, we'll just keep right on.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host, and I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.